Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. I couldn't. Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. And I'm delighted to welcome in the studio today Rick Shepro, who has just written an article called Degrees of Freshness, the Contemporary International Market for Hyper-Fresh Seafood, which he will be presenting this week at the Oxford University Symposium on Food and Cookery. Rick has been studying seafood markets around the world for over 30 years as a lawyer, an economist, a professor, and an amateur cook of considerable talent. Welcome to the studio, Rick. Thank you so much for joining me today. So tell me,
to be here.
It's great to have you. So what made you write this article? How'd you get this gig?
Well, I've been a symposiast, as they say, at the Oxford Food Symposium for a number of years, and this year the topic is markets.
Right.
And most people, I thought, would be presenting papers about what's the current market buzzword of hyper-local.
Right.
And I thought about how the seafood market has become more and more international.
Yeah.
And particularly, at the high end of the market and at the low end of the market. So I've been interested in seafood and markets for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember years ago in the 1970s being in a restaurant in Marseille that had its own fishing boats. And you walked in and there was this beautiful display of fresh seafood sitting on ice. And I remember thinking, I'll take a picture of this, maybe when we finish lunch, and because it's just so pretty. And after lunch, all there was ice, because all they had brought was, they had brought in from the boats, the amount of fish that they knew they needed for the number of reservations that they had for lunch.
Amazing.
And that was their idea of hyper-fresh.
Yeah.
But that's changed very much with new techniques for shipping fish, new techniques for taking care of fish. It's just it's a very new international world.
Well, you talk about the reconfiguration of the global fishing industry. And so is that what you're referring to, like this advances in cold chain technology and also the fact that people can ship via air freight overnight must have had a tremendous impact. When did that start, actually? When did they start doing that?
There have been lots of different technological improvements that have all come together to create this. And probably the most dramatic example right now is some of the round trips that tuna take.
Mm-hmm.
There are tuna that are caught, say, off Gloucester, Massachusetts, and then sold for the first time at the tuna market on the Gloucester dock. If they're really, really high-quality tuna, they'll be bought and shipped to Japan. Well, they'll be sold at the tuna auction market at the Tsukiji market, the world's largest seafood market.
Mm-hmm.
And they might very well be bought by someone who supplies a really high-end sushi restaurant in New York or Boston.
Right.
And the fish will make it all the way back.
Amazing.
And that sounds bizarre in this day when some people are worried about lamb from New Zealand having too big a carbon footprint.
Right, I was just
but that's
say
happening.
That.
That's happening in the seafood industry.
That happens a lot in the seafood industry. I mean, all of our food is globally traded now, but I think that, you know, Paul Greenberg, and I'm sure you saw this, just published his new book, American Catch. Are you familiar with him?
I am.
Fish, fantastic writer, great guy.
He's a great writer and researcher on fish.
And his new book, American Catch, just came out, and it talks about how much of our seafood goes out of this country and how much we import. I don't know of what. I mean,
right.
Farmed salmon, farmed tilapia, farmed shrimp. Meanwhile, we're exporting everything that's local to us and good.
Sometimes we're exporting it and then re-importing it. But what he focuses on is the broader market. Like with shrimp, there's a huge market in low-end or commodity shrimp.
Yeah.
And then the kinds of thing that I'm talking about are that I've called the hyper fresh market is a higher end thing where you might have head on shrimp from the Gulf of Mexico sent from Texas to other places. With some shellfish like langoustine, they're actually shipped live for the best quality. And lobsters, of course, that's always been happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they kind of have to, because, I mean, a dead lobster is going to be a poisonous lobster if you're...
right.
I mean, in fact, one of the things that you talked about, which I thought was really interesting, was perhaps just showing the geek in me, but the whole sort of decomposition chain of fish and the fact that fish are from colder climes than most other animals. So talk about a little bit about what can go wrong with fish and how easily damaged it can be, and then we can talk a little bit about the packaging technology and the cold chain technology that's changed that.
Sure. Both animals, land animals, and seafood, have a lot of the spoilage takes place because of bacteria and enzymes that are there in the animal while it's alive.
Mm-hmm.
And these are often beneficial bacteria and useful enzymes while they're alive, but after the animal dies, it starts to decompose. And for land animals, refrigeration dramatically slows those biological processes. So refrigeration is very effective for keeping meat, even at a controlled way for aging meat, but it doesn't work very well at all for seafood, which is why we think of seafood as so much more perishable. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons it doesn't work is that the these enzymes and bacteria through evolution have coexisted with the fish at a much lower temperature than they do in warm-blooded animals. And so cooling them to a normal refrigerator temperature doesn't really slow the activity very much at all,
mm-hmm.
and the fish will still spoil. That's why fish gets put on ice. The best storage is really right around 32 degrees Fahrenheit, 0 degrees Celsius, or just below, because fish doesn't freeze until a little bit below what we normally think of as the freezing point.
Yeah,
and fatty fish
really
freezes at an even lower temperature.
Really? Why is that? Because fat takes longer to... Why
right,
is that?
Right. It just there's less water in it,
and
the freezing of the other tissue, and most water doesn't freeze right at 32 unless it's purified water or
uh-huh.
distilled water. It freezes at a slightly lower temperature, so 32 to 36. That's a good temperature for storage of fish.
Right, and when you freeze fish, I think the cell structure breaks down, and when you thaw it out, it becomes mushier, and that's why.
Right.
Like something happens with freezing that they try to avoid
right.
freezing.
Right. It destroys the texture with most fish.
Mm-hmm.
With some things like octopus or squid, that may be give a beneficial tenderizing effect. But
right.
When the freezing technology first got really efficient in the 50s and 60s, lots of people talked about how this was a revolution and it was fresher than fresh because it was frozen when it was fresh.
Right.
And nobody talks that way anymore.
Although they still say that about frozen vegetables, right?
Some people do. I don't.
No. Okay. All right. Now, let me ask you this. How do they define, when you're talking about hyper fresh, how do you define that, and who gets to make that definition? Who
calls
that?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think the technology and the ability to transport has actually changed what we mean by fresh. Mm-hmm. And fresh used to mean just out of the water, or said to be just out of the water in practice a day or two. Nowadays, people are more likely to talk about freshness in terms of the condition of the fish. And you still use the same, it's mostly by observation. How do the eyes look? How do the scales look? How does the skin look? What's the condition of the gills, if the gills are still there? People have tried, and big processors have an interest in doing this, people have tried to measure freshness in more scientific ways, by sampling microbes and things like that. That's not so successful, partly because it's a more complicated process. This decay of the flesh is very complicated. And then partly because you can have a high degree of microbes, which might mean they'll cause it to deteriorate in the future, and it won't have a very long shelf life, but it may still be great for eating that day. Mm-hmm. And you see that sometimes with, like in open-air markets in Sicily, there are fantastically fresh fish that you can see. They're still sold. They're still in rigor mortis. And sometimes they're not even iced. Well, if you're going to buy it and cook it that day, that'll be a fantastic fish.
Right.
But kind of like when you leave the milk bottle out of the refrigerator for 2 hours, it won't have spoiled, but it's not going to have a very long shelf life. And that's what can happen with proliferation of microbes in a fish.
Oh, that's interesting. Absolutely. So one of the techniques that you described was ikijime. Did I say that right?
Yeah. Well,
I thought that was fascinating. And it had so many parallels with the livestock industry, which I'm more knowledgeable about, because it's, you know, it does this, it's a less stressful end to the life of the fish. And of course, most people don't think of fish as being particularly sentient, but clearly, like every other being, they're capable of feeling fear, fight or flight. So what is ikijime and what does it do?
So there is a strong parallel to what people are doing. And like with livestock, it's a practice that began in Japan hundreds of years ago. It's been refined. It's viewed as a more humane way to kill a fish, mm-hmm. And to result in much longer freshness, better condition of the meat. It might not sound like it's a more humane way of killing fish, because what's done is a spike is placed into the ganglial mass or brain of the fish, which stops it from sending out basically signals that cause the flesh to start deteriorating.
Right.
And then they pass a wire through the whole spinal cord and out the other end. But if you think of that compared to the most typical way of killing a fish is to catch it in a big net with hundreds of pounds of other fish,
right,
crushing the flesh, and then the fish flops around on the deck of a boat until it dies of asphyxiation. And so this is, that's what people have done for hundreds of years. Although certain people in Japan have been doing this for hundreds of years, it's become very widespread, even among sport fishermen, who now find that this ikijima method is more humane and gives them a better product. There's an Australian website, ikijima.com, that you plug in the name of the type of fish, and it tells you exactly where to put in this spike.
Wow.
It's an interesting process.
Now, this is not something that you could adopt in the fishing industry, though. Obviously, this is only for the masa type of restaurant or something like that, where it would be the very, like a hand-picked catch.
That's right, because it has to be done to each individual fish.
Yeah.
Some of these fish are individually wrapped.
Yeah.
That's why a great restaurant can have a particular fishing boat that it has a relationship with, and they know that if there's any fish to be had, it'll be carefully treated from the moment it comes out of the water. Sometimes they're wrapped in bubble wrap. And then this is also a technique that can be used on a little more broad scale in high-end aquaculture.
Cool. Listen, let's take a quick break right now and then come back. I want to talk a little bit about how the restaurant industry is driving some of these changes and some of the pioneers in the hyper-freshness.
Sounds good.
Stay with us. We'll be right back to talk more about fish.
Hey, I'm Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. Do you love us? Do you really? Do you count on us for real food news and content? Well, we need your help. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a nonprofit organization, which means we depend on underwriting, grants, and the support of members like you to keep broadcasting. Help keep our voice alive. Visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org and click the donate button today. We promise to never stop in our mission to create a world that's more sustainable, equitable, and delicious by expanding the way eaters think about food. Thanks for listening, and thanks for showing your support.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
And we are back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And we're talking today with Rick Shepro, who has written a paper that will be presented at the Oxford University Symposium on Food and Cookery in the next week. And Rick has written about how the advances in technology and preparation have really changed the seafood market. So let's backtrack a little bit and talk about where did this start? This started with basically the Le Bernardin, with the Le Coz duo.
In the U.S., that really is the start. Of course, there have always been, and they're almost an endangered species now, the coastal restaurant that gets its fish from a boat that comes the next, they're caught the same day.
Right.
But most of the time, for many decades, most restaurants that are there perched on the water are not getting their fish right from the from a boat that's caught it the same day.
Yeah, exactly.
And no matter where you go, in the U.S., in Europe, in Asia. The Le Coz siblings had a restaurant they were from a fishing family in Brittany, and then had a wonderful restaurant in Paris, Le Bernardin. Rather than creating an empire with lots of restaurants, of course, they closed in Paris, their two-star restaurant, and opened in New York in 1986. And opened this restaurant that Le Bernardin that's there today.
Absolutely. And helped by the excellent Eric Repair.
Yeah.
And at the station.
So
beloved chef.
They set out to find the same quality of seafood that they had found from their sources in Brittany. And the waters had equally good fish, but they found that they were having trouble finding suppliers who would treat it with enough respect and care that it would be in the condition that they wanted.
Right.
And Gilbert Le Coz used to, when he found something that was really high quality, he would cook it for the seafood merchants and educate them about what a difference it could make to the to how a dish tastes.
Right.
And they rejected fish. There were others doing this at the same time, mm-hmm. but they were the leaders, and Eric Huppert and others have just continued that.
Jean-Louis Paladin was a major
Jean-Louis Paladin, right.
Not just in seafood, but in all fruits and vegetables, and, I mean, everything that came into his restaurant had to be of a very specific quality. And he educated farmers and livestock producers as well as fishmongers in those same kinds of... It was like they had to bring that French sensibility over to the United States. We just didn't have that. We didn't have that culture, basically, of demanding that level of quality from our food.
And right.
They really, they changed the game for it.
And they found great local suppliers, mm-hmm. Which they still use. But they also bring in fish at greater distance when it suits their needs, from whether from Japan or Alaskan salmon,
right,
or turbo or sole from the North Sea.
Yeah,
they know what they're looking for, and they can get it in a variety of ways thanks to this international market.
Incredible. Because, I mean, that is a tribute to how successful that cold chain and that new technology has become. Because, you know, we're not... In Rhode Island, for instance, there's a couple of new outfits. I wrote an article a couple of years ago about these boats and this platform, a sort of computer platform called Trace and Trust. And
mm-hmm.
just as these guys have their relationships with overseas markets and dealers, these local restaurants in New England have a relationship with certain captains or fishing fleets.
Right.
And they're also sourcing fish that isn't necessarily all that familiar to the American consumer. There's a lot of new... They're trying to get people more interested in eating more local fish. And that
right.
makes me wonder why the locavore thing hasn't really worked here in spite... I mean, yes, we can get all this great stuff, but it is curious to me that buying local seafood and getting it off boats like my friend Steve Arnold's, you know, the Helen Mary, like, why isn't that more of a fad? I mean, I think it's strange that hasn't taken off more.
I do, too, because no matter how high quality something that comes a long distance is, there's a magic to eating something that's local.
Absolutely.
And having it prepared in accordance with the local traditions,
right.
too. Those are terribly important.
Yeah.
I think Le Bernardin and some other restaurants introduced monkfish to a lot of American consumers in
That's
the
true.
80s, which
mm-hmm.
Which wasn't eaten that much in the past. I remember in the 70s, Madeleine Kamen, the great French cookbook writer.
I love and, her. Yeah.
She talked about being in Maine and collecting mussels on the seashore and having local people come up to her and say, "We don't eat those. You're looking for clams." And so these things do change,
yeah.
and people do get educated. It's interesting. Sometimes the connoisseurship comes first, and then the supply disappears. And an example of that is the seafood markets in Venice, where there's this long history of connoisseurship, particularly for the shellfish that they call scampi in Venice, but langostino in southern Italy and langoustine in France. And there hasn't been any of that in the Venice Lagoon for maybe 100 years.
Yeah.
And but there's such a tradition of that being an important dish that they seek out the best ones. And at the Rialto Market, you see langoustine from Sicily and slightly cheaper langoustine from Norway.
Yeah. So even though it's no longer indigenous, it's still part of the culture there.
Connoisseurship really drives markets in a lot of ways.
What about aquaculture? Like, let's talk a little bit about that, because you mention it, and you know, most people are kind of poo-poo aquaculture, but I know from doing this radio program that aquaculture is really coming along at a smart clip in terms of better quality food, not using as much fish to feed fish. There's a guy down in Chile named Scott. His company is called Verlasso, and they're feeding their fish as sort of interesting mix of fish and yeast, which delivers the same bang of amino acids and omega-3s that salmon need. He farms salmon, but without using as much fish to produce the same quantity of salmon. It's very good quality fish. I've tried it. I'm not a great big fish lover, but, you know, this was very, very good. And I think aquaculture has gotten a bad rap, and I think it's really changing fast. And I'm wondering how this technology, you know, are they going to be able to do more with aquaculture using the kinds of technology you describe, the better cold chain, the better wrapping, the better catching, better killing, all of those things could combine to make a much more robust aquaculture industry, don't you think?
I think so. There's a lot happening in aquaculture. You could talk endlessly about the good and bad points of aquaculture. But one thing is clear, that in terms of freshness, properly handled aquaculture products have a huge advantage over wild fish. And I'm not talking about the question of whether wild-caught fish tastes better or things like that, but with properly controlled aquaculture, you can, they use the term harvest the fish, right when you need it. You can pack it and ship it immediately. There can be a regular supply to regular customers, which allows you a steady stream of income so you can invest in this good technology. Mm-hmm. You don't have, you know when the fish is going to be caught. It's not caught days out at sea and has to wait to, to come in and be packaged. And then one thing that happens is since they know when they're going to harvest the fish, they can time the feeding schedule. Fish don't have to eat every day. And the fish can be harvested at a time when there's nothing in its digestive tract. And that's where the spoilage really begins in a fish. And, and so the freshness advantage for this Berlasso salmon or the salmon, La Belle Rouge salmon in Scotland, and some of the salmon that's king salmon is produced now in New Zealand at a very high level. All those things have a tremendous advantage in freshness, even when they travel long distances.
I was really interested by that and also by the sort of branding and labeling, the marketing efforts that you could link to all of those initiatives, because then you can have people associate La Belle Rouge with, you know, a certain level, or Verlasso, is, you know, you're going to get a certain level of quality, and you can depend on that just as people depend on, you know, certified Angus beef they think is going to be really great, or, you know what I mean?
Like,
it gives you a real advantage, I think, in marketing and becoming a much bigger player in the seafood industry.
It does. It, some people would say that makes it boring because it's more uniform. It's not a wild product. It's not like, some wild game that you might find more interesting than beef. But it's a tremendous advantage for a chef who's trying to control all the variables that he can. I've noticed that at Le Bernardin, they often serve farmed salmon at lunch and wild salmon at dinner.
Now, how were you able to tell that? Do they say it on the
They
menu?
Say it. They say it. They're they're quite clear about
Their
sources. The French have this set of quality protocols called La Belle Rouge that apply to a lot of different kinds of products. There are La Belle Rouge chickens, and some people will only get a chicken that has achieved the La Belle Rouge title. And the first fish to be certified as La Belle Rouge was a farmed salmon raised in Scotland.
No kidding.
And the Alain Ducasse restaurants sometimes will say salmon La Belle Rouge on the menu and specifying that product.
Fascinating. Well, if I were a restaurant owner, like say I were Darden Restaurants or something, and I had like, you know, I think they're the ones who own Capital Grill. Do you know that steakhouse?
Yeah.
And it's a pretty high-end steakhouse, and they really have you know, very good steaks. And if I were running an establishment like that where I could hit that price point, I would definitely want to market a piece of fish as having a label from some trusted supplier that I could then continue to boost and sort of almost partner with, because you always know what you're going to have.
Right.
And that's the biggest problem with wild caught anything, I think, is that you're, you know, it's the quality can be variable. The size can be variable. It's hard to portion control. There's a lot of different elements that go into making something work well in the center of a plate in a restaurant. Isn't that right, Missy?
It's much harder to market a label with a wild fish.
Yeah.
People have tried to do that in the salmon industry with some success, particularly by identifying a particular river.
Right.
The Copper River.
Yes, right.
Is famous because it's the southernmost Alaskan salmon river. So there, fish appear in the market first, and
they are awfully good.
It's almost like when the Beaujolais Nouveau created a market by saying we're the first wine of the vintage.
Yeah, the difference is that Beaujolais Nouveau usually sucks. I don't like it. I never liked it back when I was young, and I don't like it now. Well, Rick, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you so much for joining me today. Is there someplace where people can read this paper if they want to? Is there a website or a...
It is on the website of the Oxford Symposium on Food and Cookery. It's only available right now to participants in the symposium, but it will be available later to everyone, and then be published in a book that the symposium puts out every year.
Fantastic. It sounds great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank
you. It was really interesting. I learned a lot from reading that piece. It was really well done. Thanks so much.
Thanks
a lot. And thanks to my listeners for joining me today. Thank you to my engineer, Jack, and my sponsor. We'll see you next week. And don't forget to hit the donate button, people. Pony up the bucks, man. It's a fundraising drive, and we need some money here. Please hit the donate button. Become a member of Heritage Radio Network. So long for now.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.